It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The overthrow of Egypt's first democratically elected president, Mohamed Morsi, and Islamist rulers from the once banned Muslim Brotherhood has raised some interesting questions. One of them is, how much did the Muslim Brotherhood do to bring about its own downfall? And what happens next in Egypt? Joining us now to look at recent events in Egypt, as well as Syria and Iran, is Ross Harrison, a professor at Georgetown University who teaches Middle East politics at the University of Pittsburgh. He will be speaking about his new book, Strategy Thinking in 3D, A Guide for National Security, Foreign Policy, and Business Professionals at Bar Marco in the Strip District tomorrow night from 6 to 8 p.m., sponsored by the World Affairs Council of Pittsburgh and Leadership Pittsburgh. He joins me in Studio A. Ross Harrison, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. It's a pleasure to be here.
You can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. If you have a comment or question, 412-246-2002, our email address, esspgh@wesa.fm. You can reach us on Twitter at esspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. Ross Harrison, you wrote a piece, an op-ed piece for the Post-Gazette recently in which you said the Muslim Brotherhood overplayed its hand in Egypt. Explain what you mean by that.
Sure. Well, you know, Mohamed Morsi comes from the Muslim Brotherhood background. And essentially, the Muslim Brotherhood developed in Egypt over the last 75 years as an opposition movement. And it developed its moxie and its capabilities as a member of the opposition, opposition that was forced underground, has been underground for the last 75 years, or certainly for the last 50 years. And what happened is when they came into power as a result of an election in 2012, they essentially arrogated broad powers, Morsi arrogated broad powers to himself and essentially stacked the political lineup, both in the Shura Council, which is the one of the legislative bodies, stack them with cronies from the Muslim Brotherhood, and instead of trying to lead from the middle and try to reach out to secular groups that brought him to power in 2012, he kind of hoarded power and overplayed his hand, and that's what ultimately forced the hand of the military and the groups in the street like the Tamarod, some of these new groups that have emerged over the last couple months.
What you're describing, I mean, isn't that what a lot of politicians do? I mean, don't they try to bring their cronies into the cabinet, into the government? Don't they try to load up on people who will see things as they do?
Well, that's true. But in this case, Morsi came into power as a result of a quasi-revolution that took place in 2011, right? The Tahrir Square Arab Spring event. And those events were driven not just by, in fact, not primarily by Muslim Brotherhood supporters, but by a broad swath of youth from Egyptian society. So in the early days of the protests against the regime of Hosni Mubarak, you had secularists that were in the streets essentially opposing Mubarak and opposing military governance. So when Morsi comes into power, there was an incredible reservoir of expectations that he would govern not just from his own clique, but would reach out to those who had put skin in the game in Tahrir Square. And there were a number of martyrs that had died in the streets of near Tahrir Square in 2011. There was an expectation in the street that he would govern more broadly than he did.
And in the end, you're saying he did not do that.
He did not do that, absolutely.
The Obama administration is still refusing to call what happened in Egypt an overthrow or a revolution. What would you call it?
Well, the language that they're refusing to use, which is a technical term, or for technical reasons, is a coup. So they're not hesitant to call it a revolution. They're not necessarily even hesitant to call it an overthrow. But if it's a coup, then they have to question whether they can actually release part of the $1.5 billion that is released to the Egyptian military. You can call it anything you want, but it was a naked coup. There's no question about it. There may have been a reason for it, justification for it, but it clearly was a military coup against Morsi.
Is the Muslim Brotherhood going away in Egypt? What will happen to it now that it's out of power?
Well, that's a great question, Paul. I mean, it's not going to go away. It has a large base of support. It existed, as I mentioned earlier, it existed in the underground for 75 years, so it's not going to disappear. Whether it becomes part of the ruling coalition going forward depends on a couple different factors. One is it rests on the ability for the coalition to reach out properly to the Muslim Brotherhood, and the early indications are they've tried to do that. So that's the first factor. The second factor is the willingness of the Muslim Brotherhood and the supporters to consider governing through a coalition with secular groups. And the third is the actions of the military. The military has essentially driven the Brotherhood back underground by arresting Baradei, there's an arrest warrant for Baradei, the head of the Muslim Brotherhood, and they have not yet released Mohamed Morsi, and they have not necessarily, haven't even, he's been incommunicado for the last 2 or 3 weeks. So I think it depends upon a number of factors, but they're not going to go away. The real wild card is whether they're part of the governing coalition or whether they go back into the underground and become part of the opposition.
Does anybody know where Morsi is?
Yeah. I mean, he's being held at the Republican Guard headquarters, we believe anyway, in Cairo, under guard and incommunicado.
There is the issue of oil. How will recent events in Egypt impact the flow of oil throughout the world?
Well, it won't necessarily impact the flow of oil directly, but it will certainly can't. Any kind of turmoil in the Middle East makes the oil markets quite jittery. So Egypt is a relatively small oil producer and exporter, so it'll probably have very little unless there's an issue with the Suez Canal, which oil does flow through. I expect it to have a de minimis effect.
Our guest is Ross Harrison, a Middle East expert at the University of Pittsburgh. And if you want to join the conversation, 412-246-2002. Again, 412-246-2002 if you have a comment or question. We have seen a new president elected in Iran, Hassan Rouhani. How should the U.S. react to this, and how is it reacting?
Well, I think the U.S. should see it should cautiously see it as an opportunity. You know, if you look at the arc of the developments that have occurred on the Iran-U.S. negotiation, and it's not just the U.S., by the way, it's the United States and the other permanent members of the Security Council and Germany, is what's known as the P5 plus one. Those negotiations have taken place under very, very difficult political circumstances. So last year, there were a number of meetings between Iran and the P5 plus one. Baghdad, Istanbul, and Moscow, those took place during the U.S. election when we were trying to elect a president in the United States. The Iranians knew at that point in time that Barack Obama was unlikely to reveal all of his cards and unlikely to really come to the table with the best deal for the Iranians. So there really wasn't a deal in the making then. And then the fast forward to this year, there were meetings in Almaty, Kazakhstan, a set of two or three meetings. And the U.S. knew that Iran was in the midst of an election cycle, and it was unlikely that the Iranians were going to put all of their cards on the table. So now that both elections are behind us and we have a new president and we have a president that has a broader base of support, was elected in a reasonably, what's at least by Iranian standards, a reasonably fair process, again, by Iranian standards, I think the regime is in a better position politically to deal with the United States and the P5 plus one on this issue. And ideally, the United States is also in a better political position to deal. So I think it's an opportunity that has to be tested.
And Rouhani seems less confrontational, more conciliatory than Ahmadinejad, for example. Is he?
Yeah. I mean, listen, he's a more savvy diplomatic figure. He was head of the National Security Council. In Iran, he had been the chief negotiator on the nuclear side under President Khatami. So he's a more savvy, nuanced kind of guy to begin with. So I think that the histrionics, the drama that Ahmadinejad brought to the table will be subdued under Rouhani, and I think the dialogue will be less inflammatory. Whether, in fact, we actually get down to there's a substantial difference in terms of the ability to negotiate rests on a couple things. One is the ability for him to actually deal, and that depends upon his relationship with the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. And that's something that is still – so I think he is probably certainly more pliant than Ahmadinejad, but a lot of it rests on the capability and the willingness of Khamenei to deal.
There was an interesting item in the paper here in Pittsburgh the other day talking about in the Sunday paper that there's always an article about in the travel section about, you know, far-flung places that people might like to visit. And there was a really curious piece about Iran and how the government there was concerned because they were trying to figure out how do we get tourists to come here. And it just seemed sort of odd because has there been any real concerted effort on the part of the Iranians to encourage any foreigners, let alone Westerners or people from the United States, to come there and hang out?
Well, Iran has incredible tourist attractions from Shiraz, Isfahan, and so forth. So it really has a potential to be an incredible tourist destination. The question you raised is what kind of efforts have they made over the last couple of years? They have made efforts actually to get Chinese tourists and tourists from the region to come to Iran. So they have not. They do have I wouldn't call it a robust tourist industry, but they do have infrastructure that would be quite attractive for tourists to come. And there are adventure tours that actually take Americans and Europeans into Iran. So there, there's no real scale to it in terms of numbers. But there is a number of adventure.
What kind of adventure are we talking about?
Well, those Americans that are willing to take some of the political risk of going into a country where we don't have an embassy and where we don't have relationships and where they might meet some hostility. American tourists hardly ever meet hostility in Iran from average Iranians, but the potential is there. So that's what constitutes the adventure.
So what would the do's and don'ts be if you go there?
The do's and don'ts would be don't reach out to – or at least the don'ts would be don't reach out to dissidents, certainly, and sort of stay out of major political discussions. The do would be very respectful of the local customs, which is women need to be covered and men don't – obviously aren't in the streets in shorts and long sleeves. So there are certain cultural sensitivities that an American going anywhere in the world would need to abide by, and they would have to be doubly sensitive to those things in Iran.
Take your next vacation in Tehran. Who knew? We're talking with Ross Harrison, who is a Middle East expert. He teaches politics at the University of Pittsburgh. He also teaches at Georgetown. He is speaking tomorrow night in Pittsburgh in the Strip District at Bar Marco and talking about his new book, Strategy Thinking in 3D, A Guide for National Security, Foreign Policy, and Business Professionals. If you'd like to join the conversation in the couple minutes we have left, 412-246-2002, the number to call. I wanted to touch on Syria before we wrap this up. There's a lot of debate about what the U.S. should do in Syria. Is Syria more important geopolitically than Libya? And if so, why?
Yes, it is. It's more critical, even though Syria does not have oil. It sits astride very, very strategic pathways for the United States. It's a neighbor of Israel, a U.S. ally. It sits next to Iraq, a country that we have made major investments in the last number of years. And so, yes, it also sits astride Lebanon, which has been an area of instability. So geopolitically, Syria is important.
And Senator John McCain last Friday, he had this testy exchange with President Obama's nominee for another term as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey. McCain said he would block Dempsey's nomination over his lack of commitment to doing more to assist the Syrian rebels. What do you make of this?
Well, I think it's politics to some degree, and I think that McCain is frustrated with the reluctance of the Obama administration to move forward on supporting the Syrian rebels. I would say that his comments and the pressure he's applying is probably 6 months to a year too late, because I think the situation on the ground in Syria is unraveling faster than the U.S. can respond to it. So it's not clear to me that no matter what the U.S. does, that it can influence events on the ground. And the untold story, I'll leave you with this, the untold story is that the arms we're going to be giving to the rebels in Syria really are going to be used to fight al-Qaeda and less to fight Assad, because that's the battle of the secular groups in Syria today, is to really make sure that they can compete effectively against these al-Qaeda-supported groups like al-Nusra and the Islamic State of the Islamic State.
Was there a lesson learned at all from Libya that by providing support to the Libyan rebels that that arms the United States provides might end up in the wrong hands.
Well, that's always been a concern. But that's the lesson from Libya was really learned by the Russians. The Russians essentially have buyer's remorse over Libya, the fact that they gave the mandate to NATO. They feel that the U.S. has overstepped its bounds, and they're determined to make sure the U.S. doesn't overstep its bounds again in Syria, which is why we have the split between U.S. and Russia on this issue.
Ross Harrison, professor at Georgetown University, teaches Middle East politics at the University of Pittsburgh, and he is speaking about his new book, Strategy Thinking in 3D, A Guide for National Security, Foreign Policy, and Business Professionals at Bar Marco in the Strip District tomorrow night from 6 to 8 p.m., sponsored by the World Affairs Council of Pittsburgh and Leadership Pittsburgh. Ross Harrison, thanks so much for joining us here on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. It's been a pleasure.
Coming up, business contributor Rebecca Harris on the business of ice cream. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.